is Open Talk Radio, The Flash.
Whenever it is you may be listening, thank you for stopping into another fantabulous episode of the Take It Easy Radio Show. My name is Kyle. I hope you are having an amazing day so far. I'm happy to be here on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash. Shout out to our boy Martez, and shout out to the podcast that you can check out on Instagram at Console Sports Means at Take It Easy Podcast on social. And if you want the podcast itself, all the links are in the bio, or just Google Take It Easy. It's on any of your podcasting platforms. You can find the podcast there. Follow the Instagram for all the information. We did a mock draft for today's episode, a 13 weeks too early mock draft, with our boy Stripe Hype Cincy. Check that out. Check out Tuesday's episode. We went through all of the Matthew Stafford possibilities, future of the Packers, future of the Bills, reviewed some NCAA financial statements. Check all that out and continue to check out all of the fantastic content coming out here on Open Talk Radio. How y'all doing today, everyone? I'm glad to be talking to you. It's a great day to do some radio and to just talk for an hour. We're going to get into a lot today. I haven't been able to get into all the baseball stuff that dropped yesterday. We did a mock draft today, so obviously baseball took a bit of a back seat. We'll get to that. We'll get to Patrick Mahomes if time permits. But first, let's get into our main topic of the day. And y'all who listen to the radio show know, when I come here, I've got 6 days off the radio show. You know I like to take a deep dive into some of these topics, and that's exactly what I want to do today. Because I spent about an hour yesterday going through some deep research on a topic that just kind of piqued my interest. Not necessarily anything in particular about a connection or anything about, you know, what happened recently. Just a topic that piqued my interest as we got down to the nitty-gritty of the Super Bowl. And it was basically the idea, as I was thinking, one with Eric Bieniemy and Todd Bowles and Byron Leftwich and Steve Spagnuolo, even though he wouldn't necessarily be considered for a head coaching job, with all of them in the Super Bowl, I got to thinking recently, and I thought about how all of the head coaching jobs except the Texans were already filled. I started thinking to myself, why is it that NFL teams don't hire coordinators that make it to the Super Bowl? And then I thought to myself, after sitting on that for a few days, writing it down in my journal as like a thought to come back to later, I then started thinking about, is it true that NFL teams don't hire coordinators? Because I went back in my mind and I could think through recent history and I thought, okay, well, last year was the Chiefs and the Niners. And yeah, Saleh eventually got a head coaching job. Robert Saleh, the defensive coordinator for the Jets, he got a head coaching job this year, but he didn't get it after having the number one defense in the league. He got the job by having the number 11 defense in the league with a team that was injured for most of the season. So he got his Super Bowl last year with the best defense in the NFL, but then didn't get the head coaching job until a year later when the 49ers went 6-10. And so in my mind, I'm thinking to myself, well, it's clear that Saleh got the job based on the work he did last season. And he was the hot coaching hire, and everyone wanted him in, and he ends up with the Jets over the Lions and the Falcons. And in my mind, I'm thinking to myself, well, if Saleh was such a huge coaching candidate this year, then why did nobody want Robert Saleh last year in the coaching circles? So then I went back and thought about Eric Bieniemy. Eric Bieniemy didn't get a job after making the Super Bowl. And now through this coaching hire, he didn't get a head coaching job, assuming he doesn't get the Texans job. And in my mind, I started thinking, well, he hasn't been able to interview in person. So anybody who wanted to hire him wouldn't have been able to do an in-person interview. Now, that didn't stop Keith from hiring, say, the Eagles' Nick Sirianni, and it didn't stop the Lions from hiring Nan Campbell. But if you wanted to hire Eric Bieniemy, you couldn't have hired him yet, and you wouldn't be able to hire him until mid-February, which is almost 5 weeks after you fired your head coach, or even longer if you fired your head coach in the middle of the season, like the Texans did with Bill O'Brien, like the Falcons did with Dan Quinn, and like the – who was the other – oh, Patricia with the Lions. That was the third one. So then I started thinking back farther than that, and I thought about the year that the – I guess 3 years ago now, when the Eagles beat the Patriots in the Super Bowl. And then I thought to myself, well, Matt Patricia got a job right after that. And Frank Reich got a head coaching job with the Colts, the offensive coordinator for the Eagles, but he only got the job after Josh McDaniels backed out of the head coaching job in a year where New England also went to the Super Bowl. And so then I just started going down through the list. And so the trend that I found, I just wanted to go through it today because I did 10 years worth of research. So I went back 10 years to see what the trends were on hiring coordinators playing in the Super Bowl. And I was fairly jarred when I saw the results of this. Now, for example, what we're talking about here is a team hiring a head coach who went to the Super Bowl that season. Not like Saleh a year after, not like, what's his name, the guy who just got hired for the Rams, Drew Staley. Not like that. We're talking about the year that they played in the Super Bowl getting a head coaching job. So we talked about 2019, so let's just go through it right now. So last year's coaching cycle, it's the 2019 season, January of 2020. So after the 2019 season, we had five head coaching openings open up. It was Mike McCarthy, Cowboys, Joe Judge, Giants, Kevin Stefanski, Browns, Ron Rivera, Washington Racial Slurs, Matt Rhule, Carolina Panthers. So five head coaches, two of them coordinators. So that's the difference I make here. Who hired a coordinator specifically in their previous job? Because for three of the jobs, Mike McCarthy, Ron Rivera and Matt Rhule, none of them had previous coordinator experience. So they didn't hire a coordinator off the bat. So two coordinators were hired. None of them head coaches, or none of them were Super Bowl coordinators. So then we go back to 2018, where you had eight head coaches getting hired after the 2018 season. This would be where the Rams played the Patriots in the Super Bowl. And we have Brian Flores, Cliff Kingsbury, Freddie Kitchens, Vic Fangio, Bruce Arians, Matt LaFleur, Adam Gase, and Zach Taylor. So that was eight head coaches getting a job, five of them previously as coordinators, being Brian Flores, Freddie Kitchens, Vic Fangio, Matt LaFleur, and Zach Taylor. Two of those five coached in the Super Bowl. One was a coordinator for the Patriots, Brian Flores, linebackers coach slash de facto defensive coordinator, the highest defensive assistant because Belichick was technically the defensive coordinator. But anyways, Brian Flores was the highest defensive assistant. And Zach Taylor, the quarterback coach for the Los Angeles Rams. So technically not a coordinator, but I still threw him in the mix. Understandably, was never a coordinator, but Zach Taylor will count for the sake of our argument. But one of them is on rocky ground, but we'll give Zach Taylor the benefit of the doubt. And then, of course, Matt LaFleur left the Rams, spent 1 year with the Titans, and then got his head coaching job with the Packers, but didn't technically coach the Rams that year. So, anyways, two coaches coming directly from the Super Bowl. So now we go 2017. I mentioned it before. Frank Reich, Matt Patricia, John Gruden, Steve Wilks, Mike Vrabel, Pat Shurmur, and Matt Nagy. So that's seven coaches that I listed off there. Six of them, which is everyone except for John Gruden, was working as a coordinator before that Super Bowl, or before getting that job, and two of them coached in the Super Bowl, that being Frank Reich, Philadelphia Eagles, Matt Patricia, New England Patriots. So then we go to 2016, and that cycle had six coaches get hired. Kyle Shanahan, Anthony Lynn, Sean McVay, Vance Joseph, Sean McDermott, and Doug Marrone. So again, six coaches, five of whom are coordinators, one came from the Super Bowl. That would be Kyle Shanahan, Atlanta Falcons. 2015, we have Chip Kelly, Doug Peterson, Ben McAdoo, Dirk Cutter, Hugh Jackson, Adam Gase again, and Mike Mularkey. So that leaves you with seven coaches, six of whom had coordinating experience, none of whom came from the Super Bowl teams, the Carolina Panthers and the Denver Broncos that year. So that leaves, ultimately, seven coaches, six coordinators, zero Super Bowls. Or coming from the Super Bowl, I guess would be the way to put it. So now we go to 2014. Gary Kubiak with the Broncos, John Fox, Jim Tomsula, Jack Del Rio, Todd Bowles, Rex Ryan, and Dan Quinn. Eight coaches hired in that cycle, five of whom were coordinators, one in the Super Bowl, Dan Quinn, Seattle Seahawks. So then we go to 2013. Bill O'Brien, Mike Pettine, Ken Whisenhunt, John Gruden, who would Smith be? I forgot the name of the coach, and Jim Caldwell and Mike Zimmer. Lovie Smith. Lovie Smith. That's right. For a second, I thought it was Mike Smith. No, Lovie Smith. Seven coaches, four coordinators. None came from the Super Bowl. So now we go to 2012 for whatever. We got two more years left. If you're a little bored by this, apologies. 2012, we had Andy Reid, Chip Kelly, Mark Trestman, Gus Bradley, Mike McCoy, Doug Marrone, and Pat Chudzinski. Seven coaches, three coordinators, zero Super Bowl experience between the coordinators. And then finish off 2011, we had Romeo Crennel, Mike Mularkey, Jeff Fisher, Joe Philbin, Chuck Pagano, Dennis Allen, Greg Schiano. That would leave seven more coaches and four coordinators hired, no Super Bowls. So that's the last 10 years of coordinators. And one of the trends that I realized was that in a two-year span, we had four coordinators hired, but we also had a disproportionately high number of coordinators getting hired as NFL head coaches. That year, where those 2 years where we had four coaches, those four being, of course, Frank Reich, Matt Patricia, Brian Flores, and Zach Taylor, we had 11 of the 15 coaches hired came from coordinator roles. And so that leaves us with, other than those years, if you take out those 15, we'll look at the trend from there, but if we leave those 15 in for now, then we can go to 2020. Assuming Eric Bieniemy doesn't get the job, you're looking at hires of Urban Meyer, Robert Sala, Arthur Smith, Man Campbell, with, the, of course, the Lions. I love Man Campbell. Just saying that, it had to give me pause for a second there. So, of course, missing someone there. Oh, Brandon Staley, of course, Nick Sirianni, and whoever gets the Texans job. So that leaves 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 coordinators, 0 coming from this year's Super Bowl in a year where there are 5, 4 of the 6 coordinators in the Super Bowl are black head coaches. Just a trend to observe for now. We'll come back around to that later. In the last 5 years, there have been 34 coaches hired, 24 of them coordinators, 5 have come from the Super Bowl, assuming the enemy does not get the Houston Texans job. In the last 10 seasons, for our entire data pool, we got 72 head coaches over the last 10 seasons, 72 new head coaching hires, 46 of whom were coordinators, 6 of which came from the Super Bowl. The percentage of coaches getting hired as coordinators, or I'm sorry, coordinators getting hired as coaches who played in the Super Bowl is about 1 in every 12. It's exactly 1 in every 12, I should say. Exactly 1 in every 12, and we end up with 8.3% of coaching hires come from a coordinator who played in the Super Bowl, which is remarkably low, and it's even more remarkable if we look at those 2 years where there's a disproportionately large number of coordinators hired from 2017 and 2018. If we took those out, we would be looking at 57 head coaching hires and only 2 being coordinators who had coached in the Super Bowl. So apart from that disproportionately large season where there was a disproportionately large number of head coaching openings and a disproportionately large number of head coaches who came from post-Super Bowl teams, because there was a large number of coaches and a large number of coordinators hired, you have 2 hires of a head coach who coached in the Super Bowl that year in 8 seasons. So about 1 every 4 years. But for the data pool as a whole, we're talking about 6 out of 10 seasons in which a coordinator who coached in the Super Bowl was not hired in the following cycle. Which seems weird, right? It seems weird that you would not hire the coordinator whose team had the most success. Because to get to the Super Bowl, you're usually number 1 in the league in something. The Chiefs are number 1 in the league in offense. The Buccaneers, I think they're ranked like 7th in defense, but the Bucs have the number 1 rushing defense in the NFL. And they have a top 10 defense and a top 10 offense. But I also don't think the Bucs are a Super Bowl caliber team. They just got extremely lucky coming out of the NFC. But anyways, you find yourself in a situation where the numbers seem rather strange that you don't hire coaches. So now you start to think of explanations for why this might start to be now that you have the data that's set up. And the first thing that came to my mind is that maybe those coaches haven't been successful. That seems to be the conventional wisdom here. Conventional wisdom is often wrong, but that's the conventional wisdom. It's like, well, maybe those coaches didn't perform well. So let's go through the six coordinators hired in that span. It gives us Dan Quinn of the Falcons, went to a Super Bowl in year three of the hire. So Dan Quinn makes the Super Bowl. Kyle Shanahan, 49ers, makes it to the Super Bowl. Frank Reich, Indianapolis Colts, overwhelmingly successful. Even if they haven't made it far, they did have that one season when they had Andrew Luck, where they were number one in the league in QBR, number one in offensive line, number one in defense. Bottom line, Frank Reich is definitely not the problem in Indianapolis. I think Frank Reich's job is rather secure, and he's expected to get an extension sooner or later. Brian Flores in Miami, still early in the tenure, seems to be an overwhelming success for Brian Flores and Chris Greer in turning around the Miami Dolphins, which leaves us with Matt Patricia and Zach Taylor, both of whom were pretty large failures. So a 67% success rate is fairly remarkable when you consider what I mentioned before. The average length of a head coaching tenure is 3 seasons. That's what the average NFL head coach gets, 3 seasons before they're fired. So if such is the case, we're looking at NFL head coaches who basically, if you're hiring 7 a year, because 10 years, 72 hires, average of 7.2, but we'll round that to 7. If you're hiring 7 different coaches a year per 3 years, that's 21 different coaches getting hired. If you're hiring 21 different coaches and they got fired after 3 years, which generally means failure, then you're looking at like a 33% success rate in the overall hiring practices. If a coach is getting fired after 3 years, we can rule that to be a failure. 3 years or less, it's probably a failure. So if the success rate is 33% in general, but the success rate of coordinators in Super Bowls, although it's not a very large sample size, is 67%, maybe that's an opportunity to get a head coaching hire. And yet, the conventional wisdom gets broken because you would think that they perform less than the average standard. So it's not the performance basis. So what would the next best reason be? And the next best thing, I'm sure people will start to look at like individual cases, and they're going to start to pick apart each of the individual points of each of these arguments. For example, Josh McDaniels. Josh McDaniels, year after year, has chosen to not take a head coaching job. So Josh McDaniels maybe would be skewing the numbers a bit over the last 10 years, considering the Patriots have played in 5 Super Bowls in the last 10 years. Maybe they're skewing the numbers a little bit. Considering that the Patriots have also produced the most coordinators of anyone on this list, coming from Dan Quinn, Seahawks, Kyle Shanahan, Falcons, Frank Reich, Eagles, Patriots, Patriots, Rams. The Patriots are the only team that's produced multiple coordinators on this list. So maybe Josh McDaniels is part of the reason why this number is skewed. There's individual cases you can evaluate, but considering the NFC has had 8 different franchises in the last 10 years play in the Super Bowl, you would think that more of those candidates would get jobs if you're having a new team in the Super Bowl every single year. Just something to think about. So I wouldn't go to that. But the next thing I'm thinking about, and the conclusion that I've come to on this, is that because the NFL prevents coaches from interviewing in person while their seasons are still going on, ownership and general managers and those hiring are becoming impatient, which is crazy to think about. Like, if this is the person you're going to have running your franchise, wouldn't you want to wait to hire potentially the best candidates, or at least to interview the best candidates? If this is going to be a franchise-changing decision, then who gives a crap if you're hiring them on January 15th or you're hiring them on February 15th? Like, what is the difference in there? But anyways, coaches, teams want to have their coach in place as soon as possible, it would appear. And unfortunately, you find yourself in a tough situation because, well, damn, these coaches aren't getting jobs because owners are hiring too fast. And owners are becoming infatuated with the candidate that they want, and then they're going to hire them immediately instead of looking at who is the most qualified for the job. And that brings us to the race element of this conversation. For the simple reason other than when owners get infatuated with the person they want to hire, that guy definitely thinks similarly to the way they think. Because if I'm not mistaken, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm fairly certain there are zero non-white owners in professional football. Correction, there is one, there is Shad Khan. So I believe Shad Khan is the only non-white owner in professional football. And this is the reason why there's only two black head coaches in the NFL. People hire coordinators and hire coaches that think like-minded with them. People hire people who think like they do because people are generally attracted to people who think like they do. And sometimes you make the hire even when the best organizations are often those run by people who bring a different perspective than what you do, because it evaluates everyone's blind spots and you can evaluate theirs and they will evaluate yours and everyone can grow as people. Because everyone has blind spots, especially when you live in the world of a white billionaire, you definitely have blind spots. And when you hire like-minded, you're often going to fail because you're not recognizing those blind spots, especially in a league that is 70% black. So if we're talking about individual cases, again, like Eric Bieniemy being in the Super Bowl 2 years in a row, or Byron Leftwich or Todd Bowles, or whatever it might end up being, you can do individual cases, but individual cases don't give you the answer that you're looking for when you're trying to figure out who is in a position of power and why are they not giving them a job. Individual cases don't work because I don't know Eric Bieniemy. I don't know what the deal is with him. I don't know what the deal is with Byron Leftwich. I don't know why people want to hire Leslie Frazier, because Leslie Frazier is definitely not in a position to get a job like that. But anyways, there's this interesting dynamic going on where it just happens to be this year that there's each of the last three seasons that there are black coordinators that happen to make it to the Super Bowl, because a lot of teams have white coordinators and white coaching staffs, but it just so happens that each of the last 3 years you've had black coordinators making it to the Super Bowl, i.e. Brian Flores got the job with the Dolphins, Eric Bieniemy last season, this year, Bieniemy again, and Todd Bowles, and Byron Leftwich, and the special teams coach for the Bucs. I'm apologizing, I don't know his name, but he's also a black coordinator. So there's this interesting position going on where it seems like owners get infatuated with someone so early on in the hiring process that that's the person they're going to hire. But when you get infatuated early on in the process, it does a disservice to coaches who are still alive in the playoffs, because those coaches that are still alive in the playoffs aren't getting the opportunity to interview / hire the people that they might be the most qualified or people that might get a job. And in the case of Robert Saleh, all he had to do was wait a year and people were going to hire him anyway. But I ask, as I go down the list of coaches from last year, as I ask the Dallas Cowboys, as I asked the New York Giants, Stefanski and Rivera and Rule have been pretty good, but if I asked those two, who got Mike McCarthy and got Joe Judge, you sure you wouldn't want Robert Saleh now? it's interesting because this might be a successful path. Maybe that the win-loss record does dictate who's going to be the best coordinators. And maybe, just maybe, the win-loss records do determine who's going to be the most successful at the next level. Or maybe it's just a simple fact that there's a difference between being in a conference championship game and being in the Super Bowl. I don't know. I don't know if it makes a difference. There's never a guarantee. No method is going to be right 100% of the time. If it were right 100% of the time, then everyone would be doing that method. But I will say, if I list you these organizations and I ask you which of these are most likely to succeed and which are most likely to fail, which ones would you say, this guy's got a chance, this guy succeeded or this guy failed? If I gave you the Atlanta Falcons, the San Francisco 49ers, the Indianapolis Colts, the Miami Dolphins, Detroit Lions, and Cincinnati Bengals. Because if you just did it on that, I would probably say Falcons, 49ers, and Colts would probably succeed. Dolphins, Lions, and Bengals would fail. Because history says those are poorly run organizations, and history says the Falcons, the 49ers, and the Colts are generally very well-run organizations. Now, you would be right about those three, you'd be right about two of the bad ones, and Brian Flores turns around the Dolphins, at least so far. I mean, he's, 14 and 18 in his coaching career, so, we'll see what happens starting from scratch, but it seems like he's turned around the Miami Dolphins. But the Lions and Bengals, generally poorly run organizations, generally going to have failing coaches, as we saw with Matt Patricia and Zach Taylor. They churn out coaches every 3 years. So I guess not the Bengals. The Bengals had Marvin Lewis, but the Bengals still are a pretty poorly run organization, but they're still churning out coaches pretty consistently. And Zach Taylor is going to get fired probably next year, probably like four games into next year. And it's just going to be an unfortunate series of events that lead to another coaching cycle going by and none of the Super Bowl coordinators getting hired as head coaches. It's a really, really strange trend that I can confirm. And I'm pretty sure it's just because owners get infatuated with the people they want to hire early on in the hiring process. And all of a sudden, they say, I want that man to be my head coach. More often than not, that's how you're going to get in and get your head coach. All right. So that was our lead segment. Thought it went pretty well. Got all of the research that I was looking for out of that. And so let's bring it on back to baseball. Because there was a lot that went down yesterday, and even I'm, trying to process all of it at once right now, because there was a whole lot that went down in Major League Baseball yesterday. I guess before that, the one that I definitely want to laugh at is the Boston Red Sox, because the Boston Red Sox are obviously going through a rebuild. They were, I believe, the third worst team in baseball last year, just 2 years after winning the World Series. They dumped Mookie Betts and David Price onto the Dodgers. The Dodgers took Mookie Betts and went and won a World Series with him as the missing piece to finally get him over the hump. Chris Sale had Tommy John. He's gone for the season. Nathan Eovaldi was obviously a bad contract. He's done for the season. And you can go down the list. Sander Bogaerts is a tough contract, to say the least. Steve Pierce, I think he's gone now, so that one's kind of okay. They dumped Mitch Moreland, even though he wasn't making that much money. Boston has not had a good run here as of late. Jackie Bradley Jr. is on his way out the door. They got Alex Verdugo for Mookie Betts, and I feel so bad for him. The fact that you're just the guy traded for Mookie Betts. Kind of like Lewis Brinson for the Marlins, where it's just like you're the guy that was traded for Christian Yelich, and you're not anything like Christian Yelich, and we suck now. It's a tough break. But why I wanted to laugh at the Boston Red Sox was only because the Boston Red Sox were basically bringing in just a slew of one-year contracts just to fill out the remainder of their roster. Like, just so you could field a competitive team, they just brought in a slew of one-year stopgap contracts as they look to try and trade Mookie Betts, and they might look to trade Michael Chavis, or they might look to trade, what's the name of the catcher, Vasquez. And as they try and look around the market, they take on basically for just paying for a prospect. The Yankees bought a prospect from the Red Sox, and the Red Sox took Adam Ottavino in the last year of his contract, which is kind of funny to think about that Adam Ottavino is going there, but also you have a deal between the Red Sox and the Yankees for like the second time since 1998, which I think the old Red Sox GM said he would never, ever do business with the Yankees, but they took Ottavino. Just basically the Yankees bought a prospect, and the Red Sox took Adam Ottavino just to be a bullpen arm this year. They signed Kike Hernandez to a two-year deal that they could dump after 1 year that doesn't mean anything, and they added Garrett Richards on a one-year deal just to be a starting pitcher in the rotation, just so they have enough pitchers, because they don't know what's going on with Eduardo Rodriguez. We talked about that during the pandemic, about how he's suffering from myocarditis, and we don't really know what the future holds for him in baseball after his bout with COVID. So, yeah, they just basically signed a bunch of just middle-class one-year deals just to keep a competitive team. Now that we've talked about things that are irrelevant, let's talk about things that are relevant, like Mickey Realmuto getting $23 million a season from the Philadelphia Phillies for the next half decade. This was kind of funny as this whole saga was going down, because I was watching it and I was just like, okay, I see, well, the Phillies are at 105 and Realmuto wants at least 110. And I see it and I'm like, wait, who are they bidding against? Like, who's bidding for JT Realmuto's services? And I couldn't find a team. I literally could not find a team that was bidding for JT Realmuto other than the Philadelphia Phillies. I mean, like, I had heard about the Blue Jays, and I had heard, like, the elite report, obviously, from the Realmuto camp that they were negotiating a deal with the Braves, which was just used, because the Braves have Travis d'Arnaud, so it was just used as a leverage play against the Phillies to be like, look, the Braves are offering 110. You don't want them to go to the Braves. And, yeah, Realmuto just took the deal from the Phillies. Wasn't really in negotiations with anyone. The only team that's, like, a playoff contender that I think could have used Realmuto was like the Tampa Bay Rays, and Tampa Bay Rays are never going to give out $115 million to JT Realmuto under any circumstances. They just don't give out those kinds of contracts. But anyways, Realmuto goes back to the Phillies. The Phillies look like they're going to be kind of irrelevant. And this is the thing. They hired Dave Dombrowski. And Dave Dombrowski is definitely the dude who likes to spend the big money. He's the guy who just tore the Red Sox down and got fired for destroying the Red Sox by giving out huge contracts to Chris Sale and giving out huge contracts to David Price and huge contracts to Nathan Eovaldi. Like, he is the dude who got fired in Boston for all of the bad contracts that Chaim Bloom is now trying to undo by signing the Kike Hernandez and the Adam Ottavinos and the Garrett Richards of the world. And Dombrowski is now in Philadelphia. He gives a big contract to Realmuto. The Phillies have kind of an inflated cap now. I kind of want to know, like, the Phillies are in an interesting position, because obviously they spent their stupid money. That was the big thing that the owner of the team, Middleton, was talking about a few off-seasons ago about paying stupid money. And they paid some stupid money, and it was stupid money. Bryce Harper got that huge contract. Now, Bryce Harper was pretty awesome this last year, but Bryce Harper definitely was a tough deal to get behind. They had the crazy contract to Andrew McCutcheon. They had the contract for Jake Arrieta, who is still under contract for now. They're getting ready to probably pay Rhys Hoskins, unless Rhys Hoskins goes over to free agency, which would be really surprising, but it could still happen. And obviously, they just gave out the big contract to J.T. Realmuto. Zach Wheeler got $22 million that they tried to dump. Gene Segura is getting $14 million a year. Aaron Nola is getting $12 million a year. Like, it is a ton of money going around that roster for the Phillies. That's why they didn't bring back Didi Gregorius after he had a super productive season. I was stunned that they didn't bring back Gregorius. Now, he's technically still a free agent, but it seems fairly likely that they are going to part ways. But as a DH last year, he was an expensive DH, but he was a really productive four-hitter for the Phillies. But the Phillies also weren't very good last year. So maybe when Didi Gregorius is your four-hitter, that's what you get, is being the 10th team in the National League. But then again, they haven't really done anything to upgrade from being the 10th team in the National League, at which point I'm just looking at the Phillies. I'm like, where are you? Like, where are you as a franchise right now? Because it doesn't really make a lot of sense as to where the direction of your franchise is right now. Because, like, bringing back Realmuto, sure, he's a great catcher, and he's worth a lot of money, and you're pushing up against the salary cap, which it's not technically a salary cap in the MLB. It's a soft salary cap because you can go over and still be fine. It's a soft salary cap in baseball. It's not technically a salary cap, but you're one of the five highest payrolls in baseball. Your team is obviously not competitive, which is the worst kind of purgatory to be in. Is like where they and the San Francisco Giants are, where the Giants haven't made the playoffs in like four seasons. The Giants haven't made the playoffs, and they're just kind of trying to just go around. It's kind of like the Austin Powers meme where he's trying to back up the cart, and then it gets stuck halfway in between the hallway, so he has to start running. That's kind of where the Giants are at. They've gotten it down to 10th in the league in salary, but still, it's like not great, but it's getting better, I guess. And so they're just kind of stuck in a rut, and that kind of looks like where the Phillies are, because you don't rebuild in this situation. Like, you have so much money and some talent, so you're not really a rebuilding team. But the question I keep asking is, like, where are you as a franchise at this point? If you're the Phillies, are you trying to get a wild card this year? Do you think you can realistically get a wild card this year? Do you think you can add another starting pitcher and maybe an impact bat to replace Didi Gregorius? Like, there's a lot of tough questions, and I don't know what the answers are for Philly. So I don't know where they are as a franchise. They kept Realmuto, and I guess right after that, Wilson Ramos, the Buffalo, signed with the Detroit Tigers. That's an irrelevant move because the Tigers are an irrelevant franchise, but duly noted. And then yesterday, the shortstop market finally picked up. Like, right after Realmuto got his contract, all of a sudden the shortstop market just went bananas. And I guess this was going to happen as soon as the first person signed. I just wasn't sure if the first person was going to be Didi Gregorius or Marcus Semien or Anderson Simmons. Those are the three big shortstops that were available. You kind of felt like that market was going to pick up as soon as a contract came in. We just didn't know which one it was going to be. And it turned out it was Marcus Semien. And Marcus Semien, who finished third in the MVP in 2019, had a really tough 2020. He's now in his mid-30s. And people realize that mid-30s shortstop with declining power is probably not the best investment to make. So he gets this giant one-year contract, $18 million, joins the Toronto Blue Jays, who might be in the market for a DH more than a shortstop. So if they just want Semien DH, they're dropping $18 million on an impact bat. And you know what? Might as well at this point if you're the Blue Jays, who we talked about last week when they got George Springer, and I said that just I was trying to make noise out of the Springer move, and it's kind of irrelevant. And now I look at the Marcus Semien move. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of irrelevant too. But hey, you got an impact bat at DH. You got George Springer. You still didn't get Michael Brantley. So you know what? Best of luck to you, Blue Jays. We'll see how it goes from there. But again, like I said last time, it's a pretty irrelevant move in the grand scheme of things. And then the Twins got Andrelton Simmons. And I was confused because I'm like, what use do you have for Andrelton Simmons? The Twins, who are like league average salary cap, so they have a lot of money to spend. But they also have Jorge Polanco. And Jorge Polanco has been awesome so far this year and so far in his career. Not this year. So far in his career, he's been awesome. So is Andrelton Simmons now your second baseman? Because I assume Polanco, and getting closer toward arbitration here, but I assume Jorge Polanco is your shortstop. That dude, again, like I said, he's fantastic as a baseball player. And I just don't know where they're going with that. We'll see how it plays out. And as Polanco continues to go through arbitration, like, it's going to be interesting to see what they continue to do. They'll probably, I would think, move him to second base, but the Twins are in an interesting position where they kind of just need talent, but it is like Luis Arraez is the guy there. They don't have Marwin Gonzalez right now. And Jorge Polanco, I think he might be coming off injury as I'm reading right now. But anyways, it was an interesting decision nonetheless. And then the meaningless move, Freddie Galvis ends up going to the Orioles, and that was a pretty cool move. But yeah, it seems to be where they're kind of at right now. The shortstop market moved along, and it was interesting, to say the least. And there's still some bidders left for Gregorius, but if you're a team fighting for the playoffs, if you're a fringe playoff team looking for a shortstop, now's the time to go get it. Cleveland chose Ahmed Rosario. The Mets chose Francisco Lindor. Semien to Toronto, and Simmons to the Twins, even though I think neither of them will end up playing shortstop, which is kind of weird to think about. But we'll see how it goes. Might be injuries with Polanco, I'm now realizing, which would make more sense to slide Simmons into shortstop if Marwin Gonzalez is going to leave. I don't think, has Marwin Gonzalez signed anywhere? Let's figure out real quick on the podcast. Marwin Gonzalez has not signed anywhere. So he's a free agent for the bidding right now. We'll see how that goes down for him. Best of luck in the future to whatever crappy team he's going to join next year. I mentioned Mahomes earlier, but I do want to talk about Lakers and Sixers tonight because this has been an interesting 2 weeks in the NBA. I know we haven't gotten to the NBA other than this Kevin Porter story, which, by the way, for those who may not have seen the news, Kevin Porter Jr. is now a member of the Houston Rockets. They got him for a second-round pick, so I wish him the best for sure after the story that Weech did about him. He signed with the Rockets, I think, a couple days after. You can check out that episode from last Wednesday where we talked about our buddy Marwin Gonzalez on the Take It Easy. I'm sorry, Kevin Porter on the Take It Easy radio show. Damn it. Damn Marwin Gonzalez. I was closing out of your tab and I read Marwin Gonzalez on my computer. Damn you. That would be a weird story if we did 35 minutes on Marwin Gonzalez. Maybe not as weird as doing 35 minutes on Kevin Porter Jr., but talking about the mental health side of it was interesting. So anyways, back to Lakers and Sixers. I'm interested in this game, assuming everyone plays, only because they have the two best records, and I know the Sixers aren't actually the best team in the East, and we'll get to that in a second. But from the Lakers' standpoint, like, they're humming and they're just trying to get to the playoffs. And when I recognize a team that is great and they're humming along and they're just waiting to get to the playoffs, that's when you start to get super team vibes. When the regular season becomes more and more irrelevant for you, you become more and more dominant over your competition. And that's how I'm starting to feel about the Lakers. Now, from the Sixers side, I can't remember who brought this up, but this was such a great, great point to focus in on, is that someone in the Eastern Conference between Giannis and the Bucks, the Brooklyn Nets Big Three, and the Philadelphia 76ers, one of those teams is not going to get out of the second round. When I heard that, that was profound in my thinking about how I view this season, especially in an Eastern Conference that now has three and maybe four superpowers, depending on how you feel about Boston and Miami. Miami having an awful season so far, but they've battled injuries all throughout the season. So one of those teams is not going to make it past the second round. And think about what would entail. If the Sixers don't make it past the second round, major changes in store. If the Bucks don't make it past the second round, major changes in store. If the Nets don't make it past the second round, I don't think major changes are in store. I think that's the one scenario where we just look around and be like, what the hell just happened? Kind of like the Sixers and the Bucks from last year, or like the Heat and the Bucks from last year, where just the Heat make it to the finals, and we're just like, well, this seems like a fluke. So if the Nets aren't in the finals, we'll feel like it's a little bit of a fluke, regardless of who beats them. But if the Nets do lose in the second round, we'll just think it's kind of fluky. And maybe it's the emergence of Giannis, and maybe the Nets battle a tough injury, and they're going to be the same team next year. Maybe with a couple additions at the big man position, but I don't see any team in the East like genuinely going head-to-head and beating the Nets. I think it would take an injury for that to happen. Let's think about it from the Sixers' standpoint. If the Sixers don't make it past the second round, which I think I kind of resigned to in my mind, is like, Ben Simmons is going to be traded. Like, Ben Simmons, if they don't make it past the second round this year, injuries or not, Ben Simmons is going to get traded. Because think about where they were now 4 years ago when the process came all the way around and they went, made it to the second round, lost in five games overwhelmingly to the Boston Celtics. Maybe they got swept, but I think it was five games. Losing seven games on the Toronto dagger by Kawhi Leonard, quadruple bounce, 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 bounce in. Last year, all falls apart, fire Brett Brown, losing the first round. This year, if you don't get past where you were three full seasons ago and four playoffs ago, if you don't get past where you were there, it's pretty much over. It's pretty much done because these runs don't last long enough in the NBA. You get to be a free agent after seven or eight seasons. And with pre-agency now, you can request a trade 1 or 2 years in advance. And for the Sixers, let's not disillusion ourselves that Joel Embiid is the star of that franchise. I said it last year and I'll say it now, is that after Giannis Antetokounmpo, after Kevin Durant, Joel Embiid is the third best player in the Eastern Conference. And now we're getting to see it this year without any ifs, ands, or buts. Like, we're getting to see the Joel Embiid version of that. But anyways, the Philadelphia 76ers are moving towards a breakup unless they can do it this year. Maybe it's a Bradley Beal trade. I assume they're going to try and move Ben Simmons for someone who is better than Ben Simmons. I mean, it's the only thing that makes sense is trading for a player better than Ben Simmons. And how many players in the NBA are better than a perennial All-Star? Not many. However, many of them become open every single year. So we're looking at the Kawhi Leonard free agency as a potential option. We're looking at Bradley Beal, as I mentioned before. We're looking around the landscape. Maybe they want to sign Kyle Lowry to play point guard. And so they bring in Kyle Lowry. They flip Ben Simmons for, I don't know, let's go Bradley Beal. Let's say they make that swap. So let's say you have Kyle Lowry, Bradley Beal, Joel Embiid, Tobias Harris, Seth Curry. interesting lineup you've got there, at least a different fit than anything we're used to with the Sixers. I don't know who else would become available this offseason. Again, I kind of didn't realize until August that this might be the end of James Harden with the Rockets. But then I realized as soon as they're getting eliminated, hey, they've got like 1 year left, and it might be time to just blow it all up. And then they, of course, blew it all up. And so, anyways, different people can become available for different reasons. I'm not sure who it's going to be and under what pretenses that a star player is going to become available. We already know Kawhi Leonard's hitting free agency. So if they want to bring in Kawhi Leonard, maybe they could sign and trade away somebody to the Clippers to try and make the room for a Kawhi Leonard. And who else would there even be? I'm trying to think through the best players in the league. The Jokic is going to stay in place. Antetokounmpo is going to stay in place. Harden just got traded. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where we're at right now. It's like Kawhi Leonard or Bradley Beal seem to be your two options. I mean, we'll see what ends up becoming, and if, like, a Devin Booker becomes available for some weird reason, maybe that's the move, and move Ben Simmons in that trade. But apart from that, like, it just seems like you're just trying to find some different way around. And then in the Bucks, if they don't make it past the second round, I think Chris Middleton is the one who's gone. Unless Giannis asks for a trade, which is always a possibility. Let's not get the illusion that because he signed a 5-year contract, he's going to be a Buck forever. Like, I assume Middleton's the one that gets traded. If they don't make it out of the second round, Middleton's the one that gets traded. And again, I don't know who it would be for. Would it be in a Bradley Beal trade? Would he want to put all his chips on the table and go get Devin Booker? Would you put all your chips on the table and go land, who else could you even land? Zach LaVine? I don't think Zach LaVine would get moved for Chris Middleton. That would be strange. Zach LaVine's another option for the Sixers, but I think you could get him without giving up Tobias Harris and not giving up Ben Simmons. But I think the Lakers could get Zach LaVine if they wanted to. The Bulls would be smart to move Zach LaVine. That's all I'm going to say right now. The Bulls would be smart to move Zach LaVine. Maybe the Sixers want to go get like an Evan Fournier or something weird like that. It's just a complimentary piece and keep Ben Simmons around if they don't get anything better for him. But Bradley Beal is the one that makes the most sense, and Jamal Murray, but I don't think the Nuggets would do that, so that's another one. Or Donovan Mitchell, I don't think that's going to happen. So we'll figure something out. But right now I can tell you Kawhi and Bradley Beal make the most sense. And just figuring out where they're going to go next might be beneficial for the Philadelphia 76ers. And then one final thought as we come to a close here is the idea of this Lakers-Sixers game tonight. Just as a side note, you probably are listening to this, so you can laugh or enjoy whatever take that I have. I'm going to roll tonight. It's the game's on ESPN. Anthony Davis might be playing. He might not. We'll see. I'm going to roll with the Sixers tonight, +4. Vegas seems to be pro Sixers. I'll take the Sixers +4 tonight. So that's kind of just where I'm at this point with that. So roll with that pick or enjoy what I have given you already. And look back and see if I got it right or not, depending on when you're listening to this. But it's weird giving gambling picks out here on the air, but that's kind of what talk radio is at this point. It's a lot of picks. It's a lot of stuff like that. So I guess that's kind of where we're at. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for stopping into the Take It Easy radio show today. Check us out on Instagram, Take It Easy Podcast, Comical Sports Memes, and Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash. You can find the podcast wherever it is that you get podcasts. Apple, Spotify, Google, Anchor, Overcast, anywhere that you get your podcast, we have them available. So I appreciate that from everyone. And with that being said, everyone, take it easy. Have a great rest of your day. We'll be back tomorrow on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash.